So this is Stacktrace, a brand new podcast where we're going to discuss Apple news and rumors, but from a developer's perspective. My name is John Sundell.
And I'm Guy Rambo.
So I was listening to a lot of different podcasts that are kind of commenting on the Apple news and rumors and kind of what's going on in the tech industry. And there are so many great podcasts out there, and I'm listening to almost all of them, and I'm having a really good time. But one thing that kind of popped into my mind was that there's a lot of shows that kind of mention things that you have found, G, but you're not on those podcasts. So they're like talking about the kind of discoveries that you've made and other people have made, but from kind of a different perspective. So I had this idea of like, you know what would be really cool? It would be if we did a show where we can actually discuss those things that you've found, but in way more technical detail and talk more about kind of the implications that they might have on us as developers.
Yeah, I think the best thing about this is that we can go into more depth because most of those podcasts are not like developer focused. They never go into the nitty-gritty technical stuff that we love to nerd out about.
Exactly. It's like, you know, they discuss usually mostly Apple from like a kind of user perspective or strategy perspective or how they fit into the tech industry at large. But I think on this show, what we'll do is we'll take things more apart and we'll look at some of these like rumors that are coming out and see like how would that impact us as developers? Like, does it even sound feasible from a technical perspective? And kind of, you know, how would that work like when implemented and how what would the APIs look like, for example? So before we get started, we have some really cool topics lined up here for this first episode, but I thought it would be a good idea to just kind of introduce ourselves so that the people listening know kind of where we're coming from and what we're doing kind of day to day. So you, Rambo, you've been doing a lot of kind of digging into kind of Apple's frameworks and firmware that's been coming out, and you were one of the first to kind of discover some of the like iPhone 10 assets when they first kind of leaked as part of the HomePod firmware, for example. And you've been doing lots of that stuff. So that's probably where a lot of people know you from. But kind of what else are you up to when you're not spelunking Apple's frameworks?
I do have a day job, believe it or not.
You do?
Yeah. I work for Groupon Latin America here in Brazil. We do the Groupon app for Brazil, and we'll soon be doing it for other Latin American countries. I also do lots of open sourcing of stuff. I think probably people know me for my WWDC for macOS application, which is the best WWDC app Apple has never made. So I think this is a good like introduction to myself.
Yeah, for sure. So what most people know me from is probably my weekly blog and my podcast about Swift development, which conveniently has the exact same name. And that's Swift by Sundell. Every Sunday, I post a new blog post about Swift development. It can be about some language feature that I want to kind of walk through or something that is new and I just recently discovered. Or it can be like going more in-depth into things like the Swift Package Manager or different frameworks and tools. And on the podcast, what I do is that I invite a new guest each episode to answer questions from the Swift community. So, you know, answering all the questions about Swift development, and frameworks, and different techniques. And you were actually on the show on episode number 4, when we just got started, talking about like reverse engineering and these kind of things.
Wow, it was number 4?
Yeah, it's been quite a while.
Yeah,
I think I'm up to episode number 18 now. So yeah, it's been going for quite a while.
You also have the best Xcode editor theme out there.
Thank you.
Like people always, when I post screenshots of code in Xcode, like always, at least one person will ask me, where is that theme from?
We'll put a link in the show notes for those who are interested. But yeah, there's my theme is open sourced on GitHub.
It's a beautiful one.
That's one of my main achievements in life, creating this Xcode theme.
So you're an Xcode theme artist.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah, so what we want to do on this first episode is talk first about an event that happened just a few days ago, and that's the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone SDK, or the iOS SDK. Or back then, it was pretty much known as the iPhone OS SDK. And yeah, it's been 10 years since we've been able to make apps for the iPhone. That is pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's really weird to think that when iPhone first came out, we couldn't make apps for it. Like, people these days who are starting right now probably don't even remember what it was like before the App Store. And Apple even like showed us what would happen if the App Store died with the intro video for one of their latest events.
Oh yeah, exactly. The world is coming to an end.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the App Store is down.
That would definitely happen, I think, because these days it's really hard to go around the world without apps. Like, just think about when you like visit another country, what do? You use like maps and you use like travel stuff. So it's hard to live without apps. And Apple pretty much invented the App Store in smartphones.
Yeah.
And just think about how that changed the lives of so many people, like ourselves. What would we be doing if there was no iOS SDK?
Yeah, that is a really good question. I guess for me, I was doing web development before I got into iOS development. And I guess this was very similar to a lot of other people. Like, a lot of people were working on, you know, back-end web development or front-end web development. And when the iPhone came out, we were like, okay, this is the hot new stuff. Let's get into this instead. So I guess if in a hypothetical future where there wouldn't be an iOS SDK, I guess, you know, I would still be a web developer and working on that stuff. But I must say, I'm very happy that it happened because I am really enjoying making native apps and making apps for iOS and for the Mac and all that stuff a lot more than I was enjoying web development, even though that was fun as well.
Yeah, I would be pretty sad because I was a frustrated web developer back then. I was pretty unhappy with the state of the web and the tools. Like, I was honestly like tired of it. To this day, like, I can't really do much web development. It just, I don't know, I just don't like it.
It's like you're scarred for life.
Yeah, that's probably the fault of Internet Explorer 6.
It's like not a day went by back then without you like cursing at Internet Explorer. It's like, why can't they just adopt web standards?
You would like make this beautiful website with JavaScript and animations and cool CSS alignment stuff. And then you'd remember, I should open it in IE6 and see how it looks like. And then, boom, nothing, like completely broken website. And then you'd have to take that beautiful CSS you wrote and uglify it.
Yeah. And it was also like, you know, kind of the advent of this design trend in web development where you were building like these responsive websites and responsive web design. And I remember like switching over to the iPhone and working on the iOS SDK. It was kind of a breath of fresh air to just have like a single device, single screen size. Obviously that has changed now, you know, especially in the last couple of years. But, you know, that was so nice, I remember, where it was like, I don't have to worry about backwards compatibility or, you know, which browser will interpret my code differently. I can just write this code once. I can have all these assets that are perfectly tailored to this device, and I can ship an app. And that was just so nice to have that experience as a developer.
I think there is definitely that aspect of like the movie director that wants people to go see the movie in a specific theater configuration.
Oh yeah.
to get like the perfect movie watching experience. I kind of feel like that with iOS development. These days, like, you have to support lots of screen resolutions and different devices, but it's still way simpler than doing web development in terms of compatibility issues and how much you have to worry about different devices. Like, I usually test on an iPhone 5S, a 6S, and an iPhone 10, and that's enough. Like, I know that it's going to work well in other devices, and it usually does.
Yeah.
So I guess that's that feeling of being safe, that you don't have to worry about some crazy new device that doesn't, like, you never heard about, and it breaks your thing.
Yeah, because it's all under like one ecosystem, you know. You can also get some really good hints from Apple, like from WWDC. Like if they say, you know, you better adopt the size classes, you know, then you can take that as a pretty big hint that, okay, something's going to happen with the size of the display.
That's a classic one. I remember like they pretty much like said, hey, we are making bigger phones, do it.
Yeah, it was like, don't assume that the size of the phone will be this, but we're not going to tell you that we're making a bigger phone, but we've got this like larger size class. I wonder what that's for.
Yeah, and the compact stuff that pretty much predicted side-by-side apps on iPad. So
yeah, that's right.
We always get some hints from Apple, and I always tell people to pay close attention to WWDC to see what they're saying, because they usually pretty much tell you what to do, even in terms of like which types of apps they're looking to feature. So they always give you some hints in DubDub.
Yeah, especially if it's something that's like repeated in a lot of different sessions. If it's like a lot of sessions about a specific topic, whether that's like auto layout and size classes, or it's about accessibility, or it's about, you know, something that is like always mentioned in all of the different sessions, or in many different sessions, that's like a pretty clear hint that this is really important. That it might not seem important right now, but you know, come next year or the year after, it might be like a deal breaker for you if you haven't adopted kind of those standards.
Yeah, if you see something in WWDC and you think to yourself, this doesn't make any sense, it's probably because it has to do with some unreleased thing. And we are talking about the 10 years of the iPhone SDK. I think it'd be cool to tell people about like what was our first contact with the SDK. When did we get started? I think both of us started after the SDK.
Yeah, exactly. I think I got started when it was like iOS 3. So the SDK had been out for about 1 year when I got started with iOS development. And my first impression was, so I downloaded Xcode. I actually had it installed for a while because I was always like, maybe I should write some Mac apps and get into Mac development. I had been tinkering around with it a little bit, but I hadn't really done anything seriously. So for me, it was all very new in terms of the language and like how the IDE was structured, because when I was doing web development, I was mostly just writing things in a text editor and deploying it on a server and testing in the browser. But here was like a whole new different workflow where I was like compiling the code and running in a simulator and debugging, you know, in native code and running into, you know, bad access errors and all these kind of things. And especially with the manual memory management that you had to do back then, it was very, very different from writing something like JavaScript or PHP, which I was doing before. So for me, it was like a pretty steep learning curve, to be honest, and a lot of just like, you know, trial and error and, you know, running into weird things that I had no idea what they meant and trying to figure it out. So it was a very interesting period for sure.
Yeah, I remember running into like segmentation faults and stuff and not knowing what it meant and
yeah,
Googling everything. Yeah, it was a pretty steep learning curve to a web developer. I was already doing some Mac app stuff back then, but like I think it was around iPhone OS 2 that I got my first Mac, and I immediately downloaded Xcode and started playing around with it. And the weird thing is that at the time I remember thinking that I would do this just as a hobby. I would never be able to make a living like making phone apps, really. Like it was not a thing that I thought would make people money at the time. And boy, was I wrong.
So one other thing that I think we should talk about is kind of like what has changed during these 10 years, because I think the iOS SDK has gone through a really, really big kind of evolution in both in terms of like how the SDK is structured and the API conventions, but also like the kind of big philosophies behind it. If you look at the initial SDK release and even up to like, I would say maybe iOS 4, iOS 5, things were pretty locked down and pretty limited in terms of what you could do. And of course, you could always create like your own custom controls. So you could drop down to things like Core Animation or OpenGL to build like really custom sophisticated things. But I've been seeing like this trend now where even if an API is brand new, like something like, you know, ARKit or CoreML or Metal or something that has been coming out over the last couple of years, it's even though it might be more limited in the beginning, of course, because it's an initial release, I feel like the philosophy is different where things are kind of more customizable out of the gate, because I guess Apple has realized that, you know, in order to actually be able to use many of these things in a kind of real environment, you need to be able to customize them to kind of fit your app and fit your brand.
Yeah, I remember like the first iPhone apps with the SDK, like the official ones, even like the Twitter apps and that sort of stuff, they were pretty like vanilla UI kit, just like lists and collection views, and you tap something and something else opens and you see some detail. There wasn't like that much customization going on. The apps were pretty much all the same. And I remember, I don't remember when this was the case, but I remember at some point in the iOS existence, people talking about, especially Android people, criticizing iOS for being too like bland and too simple and not having enough personality. And that was even the reason why so many people did jailbreaking back then, was to customize their iPhone to look like what they wanted it to look like and use, I don't know, use Comic Sans as the system font or something like that.
Yeah, it's funny how many people you see, especially like, you know, people who are maybe not that tech savvy and they just want like a big, big readable font. Maybe they, you know, their eyesight is not that good. There are so many people who use this like super high contrast Comic Sans bold text on their Android phones when you see that. And I'm always like, oh my God, this is crazy.
Yeah. I see that and I'm like, oh my God, how can you use this?
Yeah, exactly. Turns out that Comic Sans is very, very utilitarian.
Yeah, very readable. It's an accessibility feature.
So yeah, so that's one trend, like, you know, the APIs becoming more kind of customizable per default and having more like options for styling and things like that. Another interesting thing that I've seen kind of come up a little bit more and more is kind of the protocol-oriented programming. And for example, when you're working with Metal, you are not getting like a concrete class to work with. You're instead getting a different implementation of a protocol. And there's some other parts of the SDK where this is happening more and more, where you're like expected to conform to a protocol instead of just subclassing kind of an abstract class, which was very much how the API was structured in the early days.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's basically two different ways to do the same thing. They have been using class clusters for quite a long time. I think for like arrays and NS string, all of that stuff.
Yeah, and even for UI button, like if you were calling UI button with the system button, you would get a different class than if you did the custom button.
Yeah, and for you, it's just the same thing, the same API, but it's because it all inherits from the same superclass, but now they're like transitioning to a more protocol oriented, and that's visible both in some system APIs and in some, even some Apple apps. I know the Home app is very protocol oriented. It makes it harder to reverse engineer. That's why I know it. they have like thousands of protocols and it's all very protocol oriented, and the APIs are kind of complicated, but it's because the app is very complex, but it's very well architectured. And so we can see that being a trend, and it's very transparent for us developers at the moment when we use the APIs, but maybe they're going to make that more official in the future.
Yeah, you can also see something like the Swift standard library is, you know, extremely protocol oriented, where anything from like collections to like even how the language kind of interprets and works with the nil values and nil literals is all kind of protocols. So I think it would be interesting to see that kind of approach even more in the iOS SDK, and to kind of see how that would, what kind of implications it would have on our code, because one thing that I really love about the Swift standard library is just how easy it is to extend. Like, if you want to write your own kind of method on all collections, well, you can just add a protocol extension on the collection protocol or the sequence protocol. And having that option in UIKit, I think, could be quite powerful.
Yeah, what if this, we're going to talk about this more later, but what if the Marzipan thing is like a parent framework that makes UIKit and NapKit stuff conform to the same protocols? Huh?
Yeah, that would be really cool.
I don't think it's that, but it could be. We don't know. Another aspect of change is growth, of course, and not only growth in terms of users and number of apps and money and downloads, but growth in terms of complexity and how big things are. And of course, I'm talking about code size. So do you want to talk about Springboard?
Let's talk about Springboard.
I love Springboard.
Yeah, it's the best.
Mm-hmm. They have many boards. We should do a show only about Apple's boards. That would be a cool one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I posted a list on Twitter recently with, I think it had more than 10 boards. And there are some that are in the list that I forgot to add. So there are many boards. So for those of you who don't know, Springboard is basically iOS. All of the home screen UI, lock screen, control center, notification center, spotlight, that's all Springboard. So as you can see, it has lots of responsibilities. We could argue about their architecture not following the solid principle. but let's leave that to another episode. So Springboard has grown quite a bit since the first iPhone OS, which is now iOS. I happen to have the file system of iPhone OS 1 here. Don't ask me where I got it from. It's here on my hard drive. I have no idea.
Did it fall off the back of a truck?
Probably. But I don't remember the color of the truck or anything. So I compared Springboard from iPhone OS 1 to Springboard on iOS 11.3 Beta 4, which is the latest and greatest iOS, according to Johnny Ive. And the binary size, so the executable, the Springboard file, the one that has all of the code in there, back then, it was 691 kilobytes, and currently it's at 11.5 megabytes.
Wow, that's a quite huge increase in size.
Yeah, I'm it's not just growth in terms of adding new stuff. It could be just like different format, different binary format, new slices inside the binary, more strings in the binary itself, even different architecture, because the original one was ARMv6 and this one is ARM64, so keep that in mind, but it's a significant size growth. And number of classes. So there's this little tool called ClassDump, which all iOS developers should know about, but it's basically a thing that you run through a binary, and it dumps basically a header file with all of the classes in that binary. And I did that for Springboard from iPhone OS 1 and did some finds, used the find command to find the classes, and it had 145 classes. That's like, okay, the current one from iOS 11.3 Beta 4 has 1,418 classes.
Yeah, they've been busy at work.
And a funny thing, I did a little diffing, and of course I didn't spend a lot of time with this, but I basically found only two things that are exactly the same between the two of them, in terms of interface. they are two instance variables on the Springboard class, which inherits from UI application.
That's the only thing that's still the same, that hasn't changed at all.
Only thing I could find. there's probably more in there, but that I could find quickly, those were the only two things. And one of the engineers from Springboard at Apple asked me which ones they were so he could replace them and like complete the transition.
Yeah, that's super interesting. But still, it's like, it's not that shocking, to be honest, with this amount of classes, considering how many new things have been added.
Yeah, I should compare UIKit as well. I suspect it's going to be even more significant. But when you think about everything that Springboard does, it's not that big of a change. Like, it grew a lot, but it's not a huge change, like nothing unexpected. Also, keep in mind that this also runs on iPads, so it's the same code that runs on both iPhone and iPad, so it has to handle differences between the devices. And it also handles the app switcher, so that's another thing that it has to handle: the iPad app switcher, the regular iPhone app switcher, the iPhone X app switcher. So when you think about how vital Springboard is for the whole iOS experience, it's not that shocking.
And would Springboard even include things like, let's say I present like a system view controller, like a photo picker, or like the Game Center login screen or what have you, that is like rendered out of process? Will that be handled by Springboard as well?
I believe so. It's handled by a thing they call remote view services. I think that's what they call it. There are several apps on iOS that end with view service. One of them is sharing view service. When you open the AirPods case near your iPhone, the little pop-up is handled by sharing view service. But I believe that goes through Springboard, and it actually hosts the view itself that is rendered on screen. And there are lots of things on iOS that work that way, because this separation of processes makes it so you can't tinker with the internal view hierarchy or get user information. Like, let's say when you start an in-app purchase in your app, if that Apple ID login prompt was handled by your own process, that would be a huge security issue.
Yeah, because then you could basically just like query for that window and then walk down the view hierarchy and get the label or get the text field and just extract the value.
Yeah, or just register a notification observer for when the text field changes. So yeah, they have to do this stuff out of process. I think even Safari View Controller works that way. You don't have direct access to web content.
Cool. So what do we think about the future of the iOS SDK? Now that it's been 10 years since it was launched, obviously like a lot of things have changed. We now have Swift as well, and the SDK is kind of undergoing this kind of still ongoing process of not being implemented in Swift yet, but being more Swifty or like nicer to use from Swift with the different kind of annotations in the API and all those stuff. So what do we think is going to happen in kind of the next 10 years?
One of the things they should do, in my opinion, is standardize more things. If you look at Apple's apps, they do lots of things that are similar between apps. One trend right now is like having these big round rect buttons with strong and vibrant colors. Have you noticed that in some apps?
Yeah.
And like that could be a standard control. It's not that hard to make it with a UI button, but it's tricky enough to get it right that they should like make that be like a standard button style, since they use it in so many of the system controls. And like forms, I think they should do something for forms when you need to ask users for lots of input, that's kind of tricky to do these days, and they do it quite well in preferences and that kind of stuff. So adding more standardized ways of doing things that are done in many apps, that's something I'd like to see. I'd like to see better custom view controller transitioning APIs that are not so complicated as they are now. I don't know if you've played around with that, but they are quite a pain to deal with.
Yeah, totally. It's like, conceptually, they're quite nice because they are like, you know, you are making this transition, and for every, you know, for every given point in the transition, you're asked to kind of return the current state. And that way of programming is very nice, I think, where you have this like, it's the reason I like UI collection view so much, where you like return the layout attributes for this rectangle and for this rectangle. So conceptually, it's very nice, but it gets really complicated really quickly. And it's like, you can't just take an existing transition and kind of slightly customize it. It's like either you use like a standard transition or you just build everything from scratch. And that is, yeah, quite complex and takes quite a long time to get right.
Apple is very good at making very powerful APIs that are easy to use. And this is an example where they have a very powerful API, but it's not that easy to use. They should maybe improve it so that, let's say I want to make, instead of having the view controller come up from the bottom on presentation, I want it to come from the top. Like, that should be really simple to do, and it's not currently, unfortunately. And there's the interplay of presentation controller and animation controller and all of that stuff. It's more complex than it should be for simple cases. So I hope they do something in that area. But after you've done it once, you can basically just copy your code from another project and go from there. So it's too much boilerplate, in my opinion. And what about Swift? What do you think they should do about Swift in terms of API? I know it's kind of tricky to do now because of binary compatibility. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So since Swift's ABI is not yet stable, it can change from any given version. So Swift 5 can have a different ABI than Swift 4 or Swift 3. That makes it really hard to, or really impossible to, safely statically link against the Swift standard library and the runtime, etc. So it makes it really hard to ship like a framework like UIKit using Swift. Now, the way Apple has solved this so far is using this kind of like shimming layer where, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you have these like APIs that are actually Objective-C under the hood, but they kind of look like Swift. So when you're interacting with them from Swift, like let's say you're using an Objective-C option set, like the animation options, you can use like dot syntax to refer to the different members, but under the hood, they're actually like, you know, C enumerations and, you know, constants and things like that under the hood. So you don't really see that as a Swift developer, but these things kind of happened under the hood for you. And of course, this can take you so far, but there are a lot of things like, for example, using structs and value types in a more like cool Swifty way that is not yet possible in UIKit. And that would be really cool to see that where, you know, you could start having, for example, like a view configuration as a struct, or you could have like these like more powerful enums with associated values, and you can get rid of a lot of like string-based APIs. Like, you know, there's a lot of parts in, for example, Gameplay Kit where it's like super string-based because it's very, you know, it's very Objective-C, and I think that would be super cool to see, just like, you know, this more in-depth Swiftification, if you will, of the SDK and of the APIs.
So we talked about Apple being able to use Swift to our system APIs. That's tricky because of the ABI stability thing, but that doesn't mean they can't use Swift in other places. And this week, someone asked on Twitter whether Apple was using Swift for their apps, and it kind of got me thinking, and I knew they were using in quite a few places, but I one of the it, it's not in my regular spelunking like strategy to check which binaries are using Swift.
It's not one item on your checklist where you're like, oh, okay, using Swift, nah, check.
It's not in my firmware spelunking routine, let's say.
All right.
So I decided to have a look and I wrote a quick script that traverses the entire firmware looking for binaries and checks if they are linked with any of the lib Swift things. And turns out there are quite a few places where Apple is using Swift on iOS. I don't know about the apps you get from the App Store. Apple has many apps you download from the App Store, like the Clips app and GarageBand, Pages, all of those. So I don't know about those. I haven't looked. I could have a look later. So I found out they're using Swift for lots of things. Let me just mention some of them. The Music app, the Files app, News, Podcast, the Calculator, the App Store app, and some other minor like system extensions and stuff like that. They use it even for some daemons, like the call services daemon, which I suppose is responsible for handling phone calls, which is kind of important.
It's a phone after all.
Yeah, it's still a phone, believe it or not. So after I ran my script and posted the results on Twitter, of course, someone had already done it. And I should have Googled it before doing it myself. Blog.teammac.org, we'll leave the link in the show notes. He has been looking at Apple's usage of Swift in both iOS and macOS. And the latest post, I believe, is for iOS 11.1 and macOS 10.13.1. So the results for 11.1 are pretty similar to mine, not that different. But I didn't do it for macOS. And on the Mac, they are using it for like night shift service and for the dock. I know they have pretty much rewritten doc to use Swift. So Apple is using Swift, but they unfortunately can't use it for system APIs yet.
And it would also kind of make sense from just like a kind of slow adoption kind of strategy to start using it. And I mean, obviously, like systems like the dock and these kind of things are the call daemon on iOS is like extremely important system, so you want to make sure that you're using something that works really well. But at the same time, it's like, as the language is changing quite a lot, it's not necessarily something you would like to put in like a public facing API. So since, you know, a lot of early complaints about Swift was that, you know, the language was changing so much on the top level from release to release. Now that's a slowed down a little bit since like Swift 3, but still it's like, that would require a lot of changes both on the Swift standard library level, but also like in UIKit and the rest of the iOS SDK. So for now, I guess it kind of makes sense also just for Apple to kind of slowly roll that out within their own development as well, to start with like things that are a little bit more isolated, like, okay, let's just focus on writing the doc using Swift or the calculator app using Swift and identify issues and, you know, just like we do, you know, run into problems or bottlenecks and fix those, and then you can move on to the kind of more, you know, user facing or developer facing things like the SDK.
And if you look at Apple's job postings, the most recent ones, they all mention Swift. There isn't like any one job posting that mentions that you should only know Swift, but there are many that do mention Swift, but of course they want you to know OBC as well. So they are definitely interested in Swift, obviously, it's their language. And we can expect this usage to grow over time. Just out of curiosity, all of Apple's apps that do use Swift, they use the same version because they don't ship the libraries inside the app bundle, like our apps do.
Oh, that's really interesting.
They have a version of all of Swift's libraries in the private frameworks folder on iOS.
Okay, so they are all linking against the exact same version of the Swift framework instead of dynamically linking to something in their own app bundle.
Yeah, it is dynamic linking, but dynamically linked to the same Swift libraries. So of course that requires coordination between different teams to like have a contract of, okay, we're going to be using this Swift version for this release, and if they want to upgrade the Swift version, they will all have to like come into an agreement and upgrade all apps at once.
This is the part where there's one engineer going on Slack and being like, at channel, please don't commit for the next 2 hours while I'm upgrading the Swift version.
Yeah. please let's keep it Swift 3.2.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's possible, but I'll try to find out which version they're currently using, and I'll post it on Twitter if I do.
That would be really interesting to know. I guess you could find that out by checking like what APIs are available and what they're named, because there's always something that has changed between different Swift versions.
Yeah, I think that's a good method.
All right. Another trend that I wanted to comment on, not only about Swift, but it's kind of interesting also to me kind of what's happening around that more and more developers are using web technologies and things like React Native to build their iOS apps. And this is really kind of funny if you think about it, because in the beginning, like before the iPhone SDK was launched, you know, when the iPhone came out, people were a little bit unhappy that you couldn't write native apps for it because the SDK wasn't ready yet. But now, 10 years later, people are kind of voluntarily going into web development or using web technologies instead of using the native tools that are available. So I think we'll probably do like, maybe even a couple of episodes on things like Electron and React Native and kind of, you know, how they impact the way apps are built and used by users as well. But it's just an interesting trend to see kind of, you know, people opting for these kind of alternative development platforms rather than using Swift or Apple's native tool chains.
It's not a secret to anyone who follows me on Twitter that I'm not a fan of this type of stuff. I have a special disregard for Electron. I think it is Flash for the desktop, and all Electron apps use too much memory, too much CPU, and most of them are terrible, not all of them. One good example of an Electron app that I actually like using is Visual Studio Code. That's actually a good example. It still uses too much CPU and stuff, but it's actually a good app. One example of an Electron app that's Electron and uses too much memory, too much CPU, and is bad is the Slack client for macOS.
How did I know that you were going to say Slack?
Yeah. And to be fair, they are actually moving away from Electron. I'm running the beta version, and this new beta version is using a different web framework thing, and it's a little better. It's not as bad as Electron, but it still has the pretty much all of the same issues, but it's a little less heavy on the memory side of things, but it's still clunky and doesn't look like a real app. So I don't like that. I can't comment too much on React Native because I'm not familiar with it enough to have an opinion, I guess. I don't know if you're more familiar with it, but from my understanding, it uses JavaScript to run the code, but it actually uses native UI.
It's basically you're basically scripting native components and native controls. So you're writing your code and your kind of logic in JavaScript, and then you have a bridge which talks to like the native layer, and hence the name React Native.
That's fine. Like, if you prefer to write your app in JavaScript using the React Native architecture and API, I'm fine with that. As long as I don't notice it when I'm using the app, I'm totally fine.
Yeah, that's the key, right? It's like, regardless of what you choose, you want the app to kind of feel at home on the platform you're running it on. So you want to, you know, you want it to perform the way people are expecting, and you want things like, you know, icons or behaviors to work, you know, as you're expecting, because otherwise you're ending up with this kind of like a little bit jarring experience. But I think one interesting aspect of this is, like, you know, all kind of tech decisions, they all come down to trade-offs, and regardless of whether you kind of like something or dislike something, it's all just kind of a bunch of different trade-offs that you're making. So one trade-off that people are kind of making right now with the React Native route or web route is, like, you know, I might be sacrificing a little bit of performance, or in the case of Electron, kind of a lot of performance in some cases. But what you gain is, like, development speed, right? That's the big sell, where it's like, you know, Slack can ship on all these different platforms at the same time. And this for me is very interesting, because if we look back again on the 10 years anniversary of the iOS SDK, it's like, when we first started making apps for iPhone, they tended to be pretty simple. I mean, of course, there were complex apps back then as well. But if you think about the kind of average complexity of an app, I would say it has grown a lot since back then, because back then everything was new. You could make, you know, a super simple game, or you could make like a very simple notes app or to-do app or calendar app, and there wasn't anything else really, so that was fine and that was great. But now, like, things are getting so complex, and, you know, so many features, and you want everything to be cross-platform, and you want everything to work, you know, sync with the cloud and whatnot. And this for me is interesting, and the way kind of some developers are opting for, you know, let me use these kind of web technologies that might not be native or even ideal for this current situation, but it will enable me or my team to ship on all these platforms at the same time.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I'm totally fine. If you're like a small shop that does little apps, or you're a hobbyist that really wants to make an app for a specific purpose, and you want all platforms to have it, with all, of course, you having to write for each platform, that's awesome. Like, go, go and do it. But like, when you're a big company such as Slack, well, you could argue they are not a big company, but they have tons of users. And I really think they have enough resources to be able to have a decent native app for each platform they support. They have rewritten their non-native app 3 times now.
They could have just made a native app 3 times instead.
Yeah, precisely. So they have enough resources to rewrite the app 3 times, and they don't have enough resources to make a native app. I think that's weird. And another thing I strongly disagree with, I think most developers, is that you shouldn't put developer experience in front of user experience. The user experience should always come first. And you as a developer, it's your job to sacrifice yourself to give your users the best experience.
For the greater good.
Precisely. So, it's better for the developer, but if it's worse for the user, I don't like it. I think we as developers, it's our job to do the best we can to provide a good user experience. And I know not all developers agree with that. Some developers don't really care about user experience. We could argue that it's kind of common for developers to not be too worried about user experience, but I really worry about that, and I think it's important. And it's sad, because there are so many like Mac apps coming out, and then you go and download them and they are 200 megabytes and you look and they are Electron. So,
all right. So I think this is a good point to kind of start segueing into our next topic, where, you know, we were talking about cross-platform development and kind of the lure of using web technologies to achieve that. And this is definitely something that is on Apple's radar, because, you know, they're seeing the same thing as we're seeing, where people are kind of, especially on the Mac, these kind of big apps like Slack and Visual Studio Code and all these other ones are saying, you know, we're not going to basically use much of AppKit. We're not going to use so much of the native SDK for the Mac, and we're instead going to use these web technologies. And of course, we are seeing the same with React Native and things on iOS. And it seems like there are rumors, at least, that Apple is kind of busy cooking up a response to that, I would say, and a kind of way to write more cross-platform apps, at least within the Apple ecosystem itself. So there was a rumor, I think originally it came out from Bloomberg and Mark Gurman, about a new project called Marzipan. So G, you wanna walk us through like the rumor itself, and like, what is this all about? What is the rumor about when it comes to the Marzipan project, and what do we think it would look like?
So basically, the rumor says that Apple is working on a way to allow iOS apps to run on the Mac. That's basically it. There are not many details. And I asked Gurman last week if he had more information or like how it was going to be handled technically. And he told me he thinks it's a long-term project. And maybe it could start, and this is now me saying it, he didn't say this, but I think it could start with something as simple as allowing apps to have slices for both iOS and the Mac, and unifying the app stores. Like, that could be it this year, for instance, and then next year they do something more complicated.
So with that, you mean that you would still use Cocoa and AppKit on the Mac, but you would like ship everything in like one big fat binary, just like you are shipping like a, you know, fat binary for tvOS and iOS and watchOS?
Yeah, I think that could be it. And if you think about it, if it's such a long-term project, it would explain why the Mac App Store has been stuck for so long. Like, they haven't done anything to the Mac App Store in a long time. So that could be the reason. Like, let's not worry about this Mac App Store thing that's going to go away in 2 years. It's going to be unified with the App Store. And when it happens, the Mac developers will get all of the same cool features that iOS developers get, like test flight and app previews and all of that cool stuff. So that could be it for this year, like unifying the app stores and allowing a single purchase or a single download to work for all platforms. That could be the extent of the Marzipan project for this year.
Yeah, it sounds like a good first step at least, but do you think that would also come with like a redesign or a unification of the UI of the App Store, like the App Store app on the Mac? Would that start looking more like the App Store app on iOS?
I hope so, because it really needs a revamp, and that could be it. If you think about it, they removed the App Store from iTunes, so maybe this new App Store on the Mac would allow you to purchase apps for your Mac and also allow you to do what you did on iTunes before and purchase apps for your other devices. They do have the technology for you to purchase an app on one device, but actually install it on another remotely. So you do the purchase on your Mac, but the app installs on your iPhone without any intervention from your Mac. It's not like it's syncing from your Mac to your iPhone. It just tells your iPhone to download the app and install it remotely. They have the technology to do that. That would be really cool, actually, if you could browse the App Store and not worry about, am I in the iOS App Store? Am I in the TV Store? And am I in the Mac App Store? And it could like show icons for, hey, this app will run on these devices that you have, because they know which devices you have and the version they're running. That would be really cool, don't you think?
Yeah, totally. And I think that's also kind of more in line with how most users think of apps, you know? If you think about it, like, of course, most people can understand that, you know, there's a difference between a Mac and an iPad, but you know, once you have these like more powerful iPads and bigger iPhones and they're more capable and you see more of these like, you know, productivity apps and kind of desktop class apps appearing on these other devices, these iOS devices, you know, it's not far-fetched to start asking yourself where it's like, okay, why is this app only on my iPad and not my Mac or vice versa? And I think that would make things a lot simpler where it's just like, you know, you have one app store, you basically say, okay, I want Pages or I want iMovie, and you click one button and it just appears everywhere. And this is kind of the way it already works. And I think this is where the system you mentioned is already being used where, you know, if I buy an app on my iPhone, it will, if there's also a tvOS version of that app, it will automatically appear on my Apple TV. And that is super nice because sometimes I don't even know that there's an Apple TV version of like a game that I just bought on my phone because I, you know, wanted something to play on the plane or something. And then I come back home and I look on my Apple TV and I'm like, oh, great. There's like a, you know, better version of this game that I just got for free automatically downloaded on my Apple TV.
Yeah, the only thing that's stopping us from having truly universal apps is the Mac because, well, there's the Apple Watch as well, but that's kind of an accessory to the phone. So it's not its own platform still, even though we have 4G now, LTE networking on the watch, but it's still kind of just an accessory. But for us to have truly universal apps, one app download or purchase would have to register for all of your devices, and that should include your Mac, and it's not currently possible. And for that to happen, they don't need to unify frameworks or anything. They just need to change some plumbing on the App Store side of things.
It's interesting you bring up the watch as well, I think, where currently, you know, watch apps are very much kind of retaining this architecture that was in the beginning where, like, the watch was just, like, basically rendering what the phone told it to render, and then you would send all the commands back to the phone, and then the phone would run basically the app. So it was just basically an extension of the phone, like you said. While, you know, as watchOS has become more and more sophisticated, it's becoming more and more like separate apps, but still technically they're still embedded in phone apps. So do you think this could also be a way to kind of say, okay, we're going to have these fat binaries, we're going to have universal apps, we're going to have one purchase, you get everything everywhere, but then we will also make, you know, all the different platforms have their own apps, like their own separate apps that can just function independently, but still being purchased as a whole?
Watch apps can already function independently from your iPhone, but as you said, the distribution method is still like you bundle it on your iOS app and you install the iOS app and that transfers over to the watch.
Yeah.
So there's nothing technically stopping them from doing it. It's technically possible. And to be honest, I think they should do it because I don't have any examples at the moment, but let's say you have an app that does not make sense on iOS, on your phone. It only makes sense on your watch, and you want to distribute it, but you're like, you're required to have an iOS app. And the same can be applied to extensions.
Yeah, like keyboards, for example.
Yeah, let's say you have a keyboard app or an iMessage app. Well, you see, iMessage apps you actually can distribute without a container app, I think. Yeah, you can. You can actually have iMessage apps that only show up in the iMessage app store, and they don't have like a containing app that you see on your phone as an icon. So they should expand that to other apps. If I want to make an app that only runs in the today view, let me do it. I think that would open up even more possibilities to developers.
And as long as you have this model where it's like, you know, you, one purchase, you know, you get it everywhere, it's not more complicated for the user because, of course, what we wouldn't want is to have like a today app store or, a, you know, an app store for everything. Like, you know, every single surface where I can put like a widget or an extension, I want a separate app store for. But if you can go anywhere, like you can open up your phone, you can go to the app store on your iPad or on the Mac, and you just, you know, buy apps and they would just appear on all the devices. I think that could be really, really cool. Apart from like the distribution model and how that could work, How do we think it would work for us as developers? Like, if we now talk about like kind of the next step of this, you know, rumored plan, where there would be kind of one SDK, even not only like one kind of purchase model, but one distribution model, but there would be one SDK to work with. How do we think we would work with that when the Mac is so different from iOS?
There are many possibilities. Let's start pretending it was going to be like the tvOS model. If you've done any tvOS development, like it uses UIKit, but the controls on the screen are completely different from their iOS counterparts, because it's a different interface idiom, as they say inside Apple. So the TV is a separate idiom, but it uses exactly the same API and some additional things to handle focus and using remote control navigation. So I think they could do something like that for the Mac and port UIKit, and you'd have UIKit running on the Mac, and a UI button would look like a Mac button, not like an iOS button. There's no reason why it couldn't work as an API to have like a UI button that just on iOS it renders as just a colored piece of text, which is how they work now. On tvOS, it's a huge rounded rectangle that you can focus with your remote control. And on the Mac, it will be the little rounded rectangles we know, the gray ones. So there's no reason why that couldn't work. And of course, on the Mac, you would have some new concepts like we have on AppKit, like more powerful windows which have controls and they can be resized and put into full screen, and they have title bars. And also the concept of window controllers, which we have on the Mac and not on iOS, and menus. So you have to handle the main menu and you have contextual menus. I don't see a conceptual or technical reason why that couldn't work. Some people say it would be impossible to use UIKit API on the Mac, and that's not true. It's possible. Like it could definitely work. And in fact, Apple has a UIKit for Mac of sorts, which is called UXKit, and it's currently used for the Photos app, and it's also used for that the app that shows the prices in Apple stores, that also uses UXKit. So there's not any technical or conceptual reasons why that couldn't work. Would it necessarily result in amazing, native feeling, perfect macOS apps? Not necessarily. That would depend on the implementation. Some people don't like the way Photos works on the Mac, and they attribute it to the fact that it's kind of cross-platform with UXKit. I agree that it's weird in some ways, but I don't think it's because of the UI framework it's using.
Yeah, and the UXKit example is interesting also because it's clearly like an anomaly, right? It's not a standard thing that all the apps are using. It's like more like a, you know, shimming layer or like a standard interface, it seems at least, where, you know, the developers of the Photos app can kind of work at a higher level of abstraction and write cross-platform code that works on both. But I think, you know, using that as an example and saying, you know, because it doesn't work in Photos means it will never work, of course, I think it's maybe stretching it a bit too far. I think the main challenge would probably be like in these like more custom UIs, where I can see this working fairly well for things that are very standard, because if you are using all the standards, then you could kind of leave it up to Apple to construct a UI that's appropriate for the platform. Like you say, you know, a button can be bigger on, or like super large on tvOS, normal, medium-sized on iOS, and be small because the click target is smaller on the Mac. And, you know, I can see that working for like title bars or something where you have like a UI navigation controller on iOS or tvOS, and it translates into like a, you know, the title bar on the Mac. So if you put stuff in there, it would automatically create these like toolbar buttons on the Mac, and it would create like UI bar button items on the other platforms.
That's how UI bar button items work on UXKit. If you add a bar button item to your view controller, it shows up as an accessory on your window.
Yeah.
I have a sample project that uses UXKit that we'll link in the show notes.
So I think that could work fairly well, but it's like when it comes down to these more complex UI paradigms that have been on Mac, you know, since a long time, that don't necessarily translate one-to-one over to iOS, it could be a bit trickier. Then, of course, the decision could be either, you know, you write AppKit specific code for that or Mac specific code for that, or we just say, you know, if you are using this hypothetical new Marzipan/UXKit framework, you don't have those capabilities in this framework.
Yeah, I don't know how people handle tvOS, because I haven't worked on any like real tvOS project that also has an iOS app. But if you think about how you have to handle iPad on iOS apps, you eventually have to write different code to handle iPads. And there are lots of little tips and tricks that you can use to not have to insert if iPad everywhere.
Yeah.
And the framework is designed in a way that it works. Like if you think about how split views work, you can have a split view on your iOS app. And on the iPhone, it's just going to work as a navigation controller. I'm simplifying, but that's the end result, is that on iPhone, you get a navigation controller that pushes a new controller when you tap something. And on iPad, you get the master and detail type of view with split view. And it happens kind of automatically, but of course you have to do some things, but you don't have to keep inserting if iPad, if iPhone. I'm not sure how it works on tvOS for like real production code, but for iPhone and iPad, it definitely works.
Yeah, exactly. In tvOS, it's usually like you have the same APIs most of the time as you do on the rest of iOS, on iPhone and iPad. But then you have these like subtle differences or things that are not there or things that are added. So sometimes you have to like, if you want to have like a pure cross-platform kind of code base, you have to either abstract that out into something like a protocol and have different implementations that are compiled for different platforms, or use these like, compiler macros to only compile a certain part of your file for a certain platform. And I mean, you could you could do the same thing with a Mac today and write your own little shimming layer. In fact, that's what I've done for one of my cross-platform projects, Imagine Engine, which is a game engine. And it works across all Apple's platforms, and there's a lot of code in there to kind of, you know, only do certain things on the Mac or only do certain things on other platforms. So you can definitely do that, but I guess with something like this, like the long-term goal of something like Marzipan would probably be so you pretty much never have to do those things, or at least very rarely, that you have like a common, more broader common ground between the platforms.
Let's entertain a different scenario. Let's say the Marzipan thing is basically an iOS simulator sort of thing. Like you can just ship a version of your iOS app built for the x86-64 platform and it just runs. What do you think about it?
You know, I'm kind of the opinion that it's better to have that kind of app than not have any app at all. Like, if I can get like the Twitter app running on the Mac as it is, that would be nicer than using like the Twitter website, for example. And I know there are third-party clients, etc. So, but just like taking an app that I like to use on iOS and being able to kind of pretty much automatically use it on the Mac, that would be great. But at the same time, it's kind of a risk. It's like a double-edged sword where, it would maybe become so easy to do that, that there's no incentive to write these like super nice native Mac apps anymore. And I also love to use those. So I would hate for it to be like, you know, my Mac experience is just a bunch of floating simulator windows, basically.
that will not be a good experience, I guess.
Yeah.
But like one example I always give is the Netflix app.
Yeah, that's a great example.
If you look at the Netflix app on iPad, there's no reason why it couldn't work as a full screen Mac app. It would be great. I would love to have that. And I don't see why that experience couldn't be a good one. And even if you think about some TV apps, maybe in full screen, but that's a stretch. So I don't know. I think there's this danger that people would not make Mac apps anymore. But honestly, I think the shops and indies and companies that are making real good and native Mac apps, they wouldn't stop making them, because the reason they do it now would be the same they did it then. Like, they don't do real native Mac apps now because they just want to, or they can't use the same code from iOS. That's not the reason. The reason is because they care. And I don't think they would stop caring.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, like I mentioned, for apps that either are kind of simple in terms of their user interaction or use more like standard controls, I think this would be fine. And for something like Netflix, where you are mostly like navigating these collection view screens and then you are starting playback, that UI could work really well, or maybe with some just minor modifications, just that iPad UI on the Mac, like you said. But for apps that like rely a lot on gestures, like drawing apps, or you know, these like more fancy, cool new UIs where you're swiping across, I think that would be really awkward to control with like the mouse, where you just like when you're in the iOS simulator, you're like dragging the mouse to move around.
Yeah, and if you have to like hold down Option to do a pinch gesture, that would not be a cool thing. But yeah. I don't know why Apple hasn't implemented it in the simulator that you can use your trackpad to do pinching gestures. It's weird that they haven't done that. But yeah, for there are always some classes of apps that will not be able to take advantage of new possibilities like this one. When you had, I don't remember who said it, that apps are just pretty pictures of JSON.
Oh yeah, that was Orda.
Orda, yeah. So
that's a great quote.
He was talking about a class of app that can benefit a lot from using React Native. And like, there are some classes of apps that will benefit a lot from, they would benefit a lot from being able to be just run on the Mac as is, and some that would not, and that's just a reality. It wouldn't work for every single app, but I think it could work for quite a few apps.
Yeah. All right, so we talked earlier about Electron and how, you know, many teams are using it because it enables them to ship cross-platform apps, basically, using JavaScript and web technologies. So do we think that something like Marzipan could kind of convince, for lack of a better word, companies like Slack and others to move to that framework instead of using Electron?
I'm not sure how the Slack iOS app works. I don't know if it's fully native or what they're doing there. But let's say the Slack for iOS app is native. I think it is. It feels native.
Yeah, I think in the beginning it was pretty much one big web view, or at least it felt that way. But it's really over the years, it feels at least that it's become more and more native. And also, they also open sourced some parts of the app, like the composer window and things like that they use. So, I mean, I guess obviously those parts are native. So it might be that like parts of it is native and parts of it is still web technologies.
If it's not native, it's very well done, because it really feels at home most of the time, at least. Let's say it's a native iOS app and they could bring their iPad app to the Mac, like we said, either with a simulator window sort of thing, or maybe just using the same API. I'm not sure they would do it, but if you think about it, if they have one less platform to worry about in terms of having this weird web app, I think it would be better for them to use the same code base as on iOS, which I suppose gets lots of attention from them because they're always updating the app. So it's possible that they would run away from web apps on the Mac at least and just keep doing that for the web itself and Windows and whatnot. So I think it's a possibility. It depends on how it works in practice. We don't know. We're just speculating and seeing. Maybe Apple comes up with something we haven't imagined. So I think it's definitely a possibility. But it would probably make more of a difference for future app development because there is inertia and people who are currently in some situation with their Mac app, we will not necessarily want to do the work to transition to this new stuff. But if you're, let's say you're starting a brand new iOS app and you can have a Mac app for not too much work, I think we could see an increase in native Mac apps with this.
Yeah, personally, I think that the story here is more for developers who are more kind of into the Apple ecosystem and who are maybe currently they only ship an iOS app, for example. Maybe they have an Android app as well. I think that could be really appealing. Like, let's say you have an iOS app and now you could bring that to the Mac with very little work. That could be super appealing to a really big number of developers. But I don't necessarily think it's going to be something for these companies that aim to ship on every single platform, like including Windows and maybe Linux and Android and, you know, maybe even others, or the web, to kind of, if they are currently using something like Electron or Xamarin or something that's cross-platform, because this Marzipan wouldn't solve that, right? That's not the reason they're using it. They're using it more to ship across all the different platforms. And the same goes for game development, for example, in many cases where you're using something like, you know, Unity or some other like cross-platform engine. It would be the same thing there. It's like you want to ship on so many more things than what Apple could provide. So I think the real story here is for iOS developers to be able to bring their apps in a very kind of more easy way to the Mac.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool. So we're obviously going to talk a lot more about iOS development, about probably about Marzipan as this rumor develops and other news that are going to come in. We're going to try to do this show twice per month, so once every second week. But we might even start doing it weekly if you know, you who are listening to the show thinks that's a good idea. So if you did like the show, make sure to let us know. And if you have any feedback on how we can make it better, then we'd love to hear that as well. This is obviously brand new for both of us, so we are really excited about this, and we're sure we can, you know, improve in many different ways. But I think this format and this kind of way of doing the show could be a lot of fun. So what do you say, G? Should we wrap it up for this first episode?
Yeah, as you said, people, please send us feedback. We are on Twitter. My handle is @_inside. And what's yours, John?
I am @JohnSundell. So feel free to tweet us any feedback or comments you have. If you like the show, feel free to share it with people. That would be really, really awesome, especially since it's a brand new show. And yeah, let us know what you want us to talk about on a future episode, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. So until then, say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.